Log Talk Radio.
My guest today is Mr. Jacqueline T. Robertson, and I should say first that my name is David Payton, and I'm the author of Second Sight, Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey. And Mr. Robertson is an internationally noted architect, an urban planner, and educator. I thought it would be important to sort of circumvent things medical in this last of six radio blogs. Since the book is intended for an eclectic, humor-appreciating readership that may range from studious students to house spouses, from worldly explorers to homespun philosophers, this is therefore a good time to introduce an intellectual authority from the world of art and museum-quality architecture. In a sense, this final session is comparable to the introduction in my memoir that was written by a very distinguished man, Dr. Jerome Barrandes, who is a medical mind of the highest repute, reflecting a broad background, a unique modern medical classicist. Now, Jack Robertson is Dr. Barrandes' counterpart in architecture, including its surround of fine art, because he, too, is a teacher, lecturer, and practitioner of his métier, and widely sought after these days as a consultant. Jack is a former Yale graduate, a Rhodes Scholar, formerly the dean of the school and professor of architecture at the University of Virginia. He's been the recipient of many national and international awards for a life spent as an organizer and embellisher of traditional talent in a field of endeavor that has taken him to many countries, England, China, Western Europe, Australia, Iran, Jamaica, and so forth, and eventually as participant in the affairs of many institutions and foundations. And in summary, Jack, now please don't imagine that name is spelled commonly. It's J-A-Q-U-E. Jack adds niveau to the classic portrait of a Renaissance man of American origin whose architectural and often urban constructs are as poetic as they are organizational and practical. And for those attributes, he's won the admiration and applause of his profession and of the public at large. And also for that, now he has been asked to comment on the strengths and weaknesses of the product of my 2 years spent in almost total authorship submersion, with its ordeals of compiling, reporting, and expressing in lay terms the agonies and ecstasies of a medical life, foregoing human distractions, forfeiting athletic participations, and driving my wife nuts with such sustained self-preoccupation. Ooh, okay, I'll admit having fun in writing the book, but who knows, a little sympathy building might favorably influence whatever it is about to be said by this yet arcane reviewer. Frankly, not knowing what Jack may say in regard to the Second Sight Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey, I have to admit that the erudition he brings to the discussion is somewhat intimidating, if not totally terrifying. But from the kindness of his acceptance, I'm cautiously optimistic that his remarks in general will be agreeable. Mr. Robertson, if you are still on the line, a hearty welcome to you.
At one time, you would have said, break a leg.
That's right, break a leg.
And in fact, I often wondered where that term came from. Was it sort of a hopeful orthopedic surgeon looking at someone?
I don't know
what it means. It was supposed to mean good luck or have a good turn, but breaking a leg doesn't seem like the right way to express it.
I know, just before the curtain goes up.
Yeah. I know almost nothing about medicine. I obviously go to doctors, that is. But I have to turn to people who, in fact, do know. In the end, David Payton is someone who is a personal friend, but he sets a standard that I would hope all doctors would aspire to, because he transcends what he does in terms of the way he thinks about the world. Very simply, he's someone who has made a difference in the world. The book, Second Sight, I always love titles of books, and this is pretty clever, actually. Second Sight, Views from an Eye Doctor's Odyssey. I'm one of those people who continue to go back to ancient times, and of course the Odyssey is one of the great true myths, and he has had one probably as exciting as Odysseus had so long ago. The making a difference is really important. And I sat down thinking about David in the book and asked myself, you know, what affects one's life?
Yeah.
Obviously, places, people, your own makeup, locations, events, etc. But if you read this book, some of the most interesting parts of it to me have to do with childhood and growing up in Baltimore. And his discussion of place, something that is very dear to my heart, is as perceptive as almost anyone I've ever read. And he describes a city that I knew and continue to know pretty well, but not like he did. And he made it into something that you could see was location fashions and shapes your life. There's no question. His family and his upbringing, which are different from his talents and his interests and needs, are enormously important, because he grows up in a loving family and, in essence, has little to worry about. He's safe and secure.
Yeah.
That's a huge privilege
in
the world. None of us choose where we're born. And
yeah.
It could have been Baltimore. It could have been Bangladesh. We don't have the choice. You're born in one place, and you have a hell of a lot better chances of surviving than in another. It's what you do with the luck of that draw. So many people that we all know have enormous talents, and some of them are bright as hell. Very few of them combine that with the notion of what one can give to others, and most importantly, as some wise people have said, character counts in the end. It counts as much as anything. David has it in spades.
I think it was a sense of obligation that began to grow in me from what, as you referred to, from a privileged birth, from a privileged family. It just struck me early on that that I couldn't just continually accept it. I had to try. I might fail, but I had to try to some way justify that good luck that you referred to, because that's what it was. Anyway, it was so. You know, I guess in some ways I wish I could better share that feeling of a nascent ambition that derives from privilege rather than ambition that derives from lack of opportunity. But it sure as hell was strong with me. The more I thought about how lucky I was in going to those private schools and colleges and having my clothes allowance paid for and whatever other silly little things like that, except for my allowance to take out girls, which I was always bitching about because I never had enough. but at any rate, with all those things, that incentive that came with the privilege was partly due, I think, and I tried to explain that, to the realization that I was following in my father's footsteps almost irresistibly. And as I did, I felt those footsteps were large, and I had to damn well fill them somehow. Does that come across like that?
It's easy for me. We share fathers who are standard setters who we want to live up to. We have to do something that shows that we appreciate what they've given us and who they are. I mean, your father was an extraordinary man, and he was at the right place at the right time. I think it's hard for many people who don't read your book or don't know the history of medicine and where it's located. Hopkins was really a mecca, as you say in your book. Time that you was there. So, and it was, you know, it, those people who know Baltimore, it wasn't in the greatest part of town. But it was an outstanding place.
Yeah.
And so you were there at the right time. Your father was there at the right time. You saw the best professional standards from the beginning. So you had a huge leg up. That you
certainly did.
Carried that forward is the point.
The interesting thing about that, because my dad, he was at the right time also, and so was I, but yet the times were changing so rapidly. What he knew about medicine was so different from what I was being taught, and what I was being taught was soon to be outmoded in large measure by this technological revolution that was striking us. And yet, if my own view is that Hopkins somehow survived that in terms of maintaining the same kind of caring relationship between physician and patient, and prioritizing the reward of patient care over the other rewards that come to successful doctors or professors or so on. It's a very interesting environment when you go to Johns Hopkins Hospital these days and meet with some of those people. They still have that same sense of devotion to a profession, which makes them so proud. It's a cliquish kind of a feeling, but it's a wonderful feeling because you feel like you're meeting people who are wound up and deeply involved in the same excitement, which is, in this case, medicine. That's why when I hear of people today who say, well, I'd never tell my son to go into medicine, and many of the doctors are saying that, I feel so badly about that because it seems a shame if there are people with scientific minds and a bent toward care of people that if they miss that privilege, because once again I'm speaking about a privileged life that leads into a vast series of privileges in terms of patient care. It sounds so self-effacing or so kindly, and it isn't meant to be at all. I really consider it, Jack, as a form of selfishness, a feeling that
sure.
You just can't get enough of.
Yep.
It's just a different thing. It's like an indirect reward. Some people get their reward directly by the whatever that recognition is in the plaque. Other people find the greatest reward in the return that it gets. You give something, and the return is a human return. And I know it sounds sort of... I know that it sounds so much like it's trying to fit into some idealistic frame, but I can't say it otherwise. If that's what
listen,
then that's what it is.
one ambition is enormously important.
Yes, and I had that.
You had a lot of it. You also, yeah. The thing about the book that I probably enjoyed the most are smaller aspects of it. There's some things that go on in your life that are quite extraordinary in and of themselves, and your reaction to them that tells everyone what you're about. You deal with setbacks, and life is filled with setbacks and disillusionments. And at the same time, you have to keep your standards high, and you have to respect yourself. My father once told me two or three things that was so wise. He said, everyone gets older. Unfortunately, not everyone grows up. And you see 60, 70-year-olds are still children, and they behave that way.
Yeah.
And you wonder how come they didn't grow up. You generally grow up by seeing things that happen catch your attention that become enormously important, particularly people who've seen poverty, sickness, destruction, and seen how others have fought to protect themselves against these things. Both you and your father did something that I find so remarkable. You invented something that had to be invented.
First, right?
He got there, and the whole notion of the eye bank and going to Sing Sing to get the eyes of people who had been electrocuted was astoundingly interesting to me. because it showed how you have to go around the corner to figure out how to do something. Yeah. Most of the major progress in the world is putting in place obvious things that it takes you a long time to understand the obvious. The description of finding two eyeballs in the refrigerator by your wife.
It was actually the cook. Yeah.
And I thought,
that was a stunning thing.
Yeah, it was a stunning thing. that you, also as a young man, you go off to Newfoundland. Now, I've been to Newfoundland because I like the salmon fish.
And yeah,
Newfoundland,
really.
God-forsaken places in the world.
It sure
and
was.
And you go up there just married to get into the action, to help people in far-off places who don't have medical help.
Yeah, I was still a medical student.
Yeah.
I was still a medical student when I did that. I just couldn't wait to be a clinical doctor, and that was the greatest opportunity for it. And my wife was willing to go, and in fact, she had a very good time also. But it was very eye-opening, if you'll excuse the expression, from an eye doctor. And it led to this, the beginning of a contagion, a wanderlust with a purpose, a feeling that there was always more out there that was not only rewarding in terms of participation in it, but also very satisfying from the fact of everything is different, and you learn how to adapt to those differences, and then you come back, Jack, and you know this because you're a world traveler in many ways. You come back with infinitely more sensitivity than you went away with, and one of the things I write about in the book is my really maybe too sensitive a feeling about the unfortunateness of arrogance. Arrogance to me is such a dreadful thing, and I picked it up in quite a number of ways. But I swear that people who have had that experiences of participating in life in developing nations for any sustained period of time simply cannot return as arrogant people. It just doesn't happen. It's a cure or a preventive aspect. It's an amazing brotherhood of people and sisterhood of people who have done these things. And at least I hope I'm not arrogant, because I certainly don't like it. But
well,
that's the thing I say about
that. Without an ego, you couldn't have done the things you've done.
That's true.
It's arrogant.
Yeah.
The ego is healthy.
Yeah, I try to make a distinction between that and arrogance.
So do I. They're different.
Yeah, very different, yeah.
You can't accomplish anything. It's like high-octane gas. No one who is worth doing anything is without ego.
Yeah, yeah.
But they can learn to be without arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the lessons.
Very well.
Travel, I was lucky at 12, 13 years old, went to China at the end of the Second War.
Mm-hmm.
And saw a totally different world. I saw it flying over oceans that I'd known only in terms of the war. I saw it in a totally different, the oldest culture in the world, in the midst of seismic change. And it changed everything that I thought about when I came home. I realized that the world was a very large place, and there were many different things going on that one knew nothing about and had to try to find out more about. And travel is supposed to, it's not for pleasure. You don't do it as a sightseer. You do it to learn how things work in different places.
True, Jack. I love hearing it from you because you say it well. And you know, when Diane and I talk about travel, and we talk about some of the great places in the world to visit, I have seen quite a lot of them, but 9 out of 10 experiences I've had in the developing nations, not in these many of those famous wonderful places like Mallorca, for example, or some of the really wonderful feeding spots for the fancy and well fortified financially persons. Instead, I'm a stranger really there, but I'm familiar and comfortable in many of these other places because they're adventuresome and they're challenging and they've really been wonderful. That's what that led me into this feeling for global ophthalmology, the involvement of this specialty in the people of the world and the person back in the United States where you can get better training and better knowledge of medicine and the techniques of managing eye disease better than any other country. I mean, let's face it, that's the truth. And to be able to offer those things abroad was something that was an incurable way of a commitment, so to speak. And I think you reflected that in your own experience. I mean, you've had remarkable experiences in numerous countries in various stages of development, and surely with particular attention to the architecture of those countries and the way that
how they work, people. What their culture is, how they work, yeah. Why they're different from us, why it's impossible to go tell other countries how to behave. I mean, that's an arrogance that drives me crazy in the United
me
States.
Me too.
People what to do and how to do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We're a young country still. And we tell that to countries that have 5,000-year-old histories. I mean, come on. I would like, it's very interesting because you've been a lot of places, and a lot of them are places I've been to too. You've also met people. I want to really ask you about what meeting people who have names, as it were, who are key figures. One of your soundest points, Peyton, is the following. If you want to get something done that's really important at a high level, you go to the top first, never to the bottom. You never climb up the ladder. You use whatever leverage you have to get to the top. And it's the only way to get things done. And some people have a capacity to do that. You were one of them, and it's why so many of the things that you wanted to do, you were able to get done. Now, I look at Madame Chiang Kai-shek. I spent a week with Madame Chiang Kai-shek in Nanking when I was 13 years old, living in her palace and was sort of a rented child. I came down from Peking where my father was working. Now, she's a piece of work. And for the rest of her life, every Christmas, she would send my mother in Virginia, my mother lived to be 101, the most elaborate presents.
Really?
The Shah of Iran. I worked for him for 4 years. I knew him as well as an outsider can possibly know someone. He was a basically good guy who, not as strong as his father, and missed the most obvious point, that he was the head of a country that had a 3,000-year-old history, Persia, but had become Muslim, and that he ignored the religion of the country. It's like trying to work in Alabama and run Alabama without taking the Baptist church in mind. And he really missed that. It was a huge miss. And he didn't have to lose the country at all. But he did because he didn't know his own country well enough.
You think it was his handlers that the people in
No, well, listen, the hangers-on around everyone like a Shah are many. But in the end, you have to understand he had many ayatollahs, many of the top religious leaders who were with him, who wanted to modernize, take the Shadur off, send women to school, et cetera, et cetera. Iran is one of the greatest countries in the world. And it still is. And it's totally misunderstood in this country. And it's too bad because it's probably the first or second best country anywhere near in the Middle East.
It's an amazing country. I agree with that and quite beautiful. But let me ask you.
Also had Nur, who you met. Queen Nua worked for me in Iran.
Oh,
her
did
father
she?
Was a terrific guy. He ran Pan-American, and she'd gone to Princeton Architecture School and tried to get a job with our firm in Australia and couldn't, and came to work for me in Iran. And she was later on introduced to the King of Jordan, and you know, she married him and became Queen Nur.
Yeah.
Now, one of the brighter people you met, who very few people knew, I knew intimately, was Siaga. Siaga was the initially development director in Jamaica and became the
Harvard educated.
And one of the most brilliant people I've ever known, and at the same time, most practical. I did a long study there that showed him how he had a piece of land on the west end of Jamaica, that he should not allow high-rise buildings there. He should protect the landscape. He should build low-rise building. He should do fish farming, all those things. And he, in 20 years, he would have the most valuable property in the Caribbean. He said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Robertson, you're right. I can't do that because my people think that I will be talking down to them and that they are not good enough to have high-rise buildings." I said,
that's an interesting,
a leader's job to persuade people to do things that don't look right now but that they know are right in the future. And he said, "Yes, but you understood. I'm an outsider," because he's Lebanese.
Yep, sure.
And the people who supported Siaga were probably the toughest crowd in all of Jamaica. Many years later, I met him at a conference, and it's when he was PM. He came over to me and said, "Oh, Mr. Robertson, I remember you gave me the right advice. I was sorry I couldn't take it."
Oh, that's so good. Well, now,
I was interested that everyone who's ever met Siaga said it's one of the half a dozen brightest people I've ever seen.
But he understood what to do and not do. I saw him less than I saw his wife then, his wife called Mitzi. I started with him first by suggesting that he loved fish tanks, and he had freshwater fish in his tanks in his in the beautiful Vale Royal where the premier lived. And I said he should have saltwater tanks with local fish.
Yep.
That was a thought that he hadn't had before. But to me, in thinking about these people that you've talked about that I got to see, I sort of saw them from behind. Like, for example, the Siagas, I, for some reason, was able to go on that trip to another island with Mitzi and her children that day. And we came back with the child having been thrown up all over my lap, getting back into the kitchen because he was entertaining some very fancy people in the drawing room, and there was a waiter in a white coat who was going to take in the tea, but we had to fix the tea. So I'd never met them before. There I was padding around with the throw up of this kid still on me, trying to help Mitzi find the things that had to be put on that tray and get the butler sent in with the tray to these other people, and then they came to dinner with me that night, even with their entourage of armed guards that were to guard them. And as soon as they got into the dining room, they put their guns away, and they were eating at my expense, which was a surprise to me, and never looked up from the table. But anyway, we had no troubles. The Siagas were loved in that group, and we had a good time. But the other thing you mentioned about Madame Chang, although I had an interesting time with her, the part that I found most amusing, and also at the time it wasn't all so funny, was when I had to struggle with my wet socks and having gotten off the plane and not thinking that I was going to be met at the airplane by all those ophthalmologists. There were 13 of them and one nurse. And the head guy, the head professor, Dr. Chen, grabbed my bag, and there I had six pairs of wet socks drying out because I thought I'd arrive anonymously, and I'd been all over Africa and Vietnam, and I needed socks, so I washed them before I got on the airplane. And they just were dribbled all along the tarmac and into the airport, and that's when I was in the middle, and I had six people on one side and seven people on another side, and we would just all go along. They were all smiling and nodding and saying nice things, and they spoke a little bit of English. And but I was always allowed to reach down further than anybody else, and I grabbed the socks, and they very politely made gestures in that direction. And so I arrived at customs, or what do you say, procedures, formalities, with 12 wet socks in my arm. And as I say in the book, that was the most stupendous example of losing face as a young guy. I was just 40, and in a very important, I felt, very important mission to Madam Chang. And here yep. I was with my socks spilling all over the airport, and much the embarrassment of colleagues that I thought, well, that's the, certainly they can't have any respect for this stupid American. And so it goes. Each time, I think, the people that I talk about, because I, too, find people of leadership to be absolutely fantastically interesting. I always had some things to say in respect, sort of from the back room or from undercover or from the back door, in which I was able to meet and see them, and it made them more real and more lively in my account. And I love telling those stories.
Well,
I think about the current president or dictator of Syria. He started life as an ophthalmologist. He was being trained at Moorfields when his father died, and he was called back. And when he was called back from Moorfields, that wonderful institution in London, he was thought of as a very decent fellow. To the best of my knowledge, he was thought, well, this is going to be a big change, and look what's happened. My gosh, he's been firing on innocent people, and we've asked him to step aside.
Parent cultures are difficult to change.
Absolutely.
And the couple of things that I'd like your comment on. One is, after your father creates this iBank, you go out and create Orbis. Now, it's a And the one of the things I liked was the picture. I love pictures, as you know,
yeah.
On the cover of your book.
A little diagram. Yeah.
There's a diagram of an airplane with a
yeah.
teaching area and an operating area in the middle of it. And I look
yeah.
at it, and I said, God damn it, is that a smart idea? So smart and
yeah.
so basic.
Yeah.
There was a very brilliant museum director in Richmond when I grew up at the Virginia Museum named Leslie Cheek. He was incredibly knowledgeable.
Hmm.
His wife was Douglas Southall Freeman's, the great biographer's daughter. She was brilliant. Leslie Cheek kept saying, all of the people who have money and travel can come to my museum and see things.
Yeah.
People who live up in the mountains and in the outback of Virginia, they've never seen anything like this. And my job is to figure out how to get to them. So he goes out and he says, he buys the biggest trailer truck he can get. He has it refinished, and it becomes a small traveling museum.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's called the Artmobile.
Yeah.
And he and his curators drive it all over the state for 1 month of every year, going to every back town, and it's astoundingly expensive in terms of what the payout is, and you have people coming from all over the countryside to see these automobiles because someone was smart enough to realize that transporting the good stuff to them and not them can't afford to come to where the good stuff is. And it's exactly what you did with Orbis. You said it's not only you fly out there and train people to do what needs to be done, but you also perform operations there. And
yeah.
the good
In fact,
thing,
the operations
the thing that is
the, no, I was
appealing
gonna say the operations
about
only,
life yeah. is that you think about and organize things as well as teach, as well as operate. You're doing all of those things simultaneously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what makes really good people good. Because you could just operate and then, you know, go to Florida. doing the teaching, helping people out where it's needed, operating and learning, continuing to learn, is what it's about. And everyone who's been given the kind of privileges that and have earned them, as you have, knows this. I'd like to hear your take, because I read the book, and you know, Orbis brought you a lot of heartbreak at one point in the book.
It did.
And that also, the candor of that heartbreak was incredibly important, because it was so candid and real, palpable.
Well, it you know, Jack, the thing about Orbis that, in terms of its inspiration to getting it going, was the fact that it was an extraordinarily expensive gamble. I had to talk to people who are financiers or CEOs or heads of foundations and say, look, we need to, for the first time in the history of surgery since Hippocrates, we can only teach eye surgery, this form of eye surgery, by hands-on instruction. So we have to have teachers go there. And therefore, I've concluded, and others, one or two people also agree, that it'd be practical if we did it on an old commercial airline. Well, those people thought that was a pretty good idea. As after a while, because I would go there and be as persuasive as I possibly can, along with Betsy Tripp, Mr. Juan Tripp's daughter, who would very often be the person setting up the meeting. But here's the problem. I'd come back and talk to ophthalmologists about it, and the ophthalmologists thought it was the damnedest harebrained thing they'd ever heard, because they knew all the complications of having surgery that can't be. I mean, you can't have exposure, can't have contamination in the operating room, you can't have vibration of the microscope, you have to have a certain amount of air circulation, you have to be able to scrub with clean water, you have to have electricity that is reliable and isn't going to go out from any local source. There were so many reasons why it didn't work. So that, let's say that some wealthy potential donor would listen to my story, and then he'd call up his eye doctor and he said, well, I want to just, you know, get your thoughts about this. Or he'd say it when he sees him in the office, you know, for a routine check. And he'd say, what do you think about this idea of patents? Is that going to fly? You know, he's asking for money. And the guy would, you know, he didn't have to say anything. All he had to do is stick his thumb up in his clenched fist and turn it 180 degrees until the thumb was pointing down.
Yep.
No further word. Nothing needed to be said. Yep. And that was what we had to fight against. My buddies, so to speak. But they, after all, they were giving their honest thought. They didn't think it was practical, and they probably knew more about it than, certainly knew more about it than the aeronautical people, or even the non-medical and non-aeronautical people. so we were fighting against a lot of assumptions, and that's another thing that is always an interesting thing. People can condemn
reason,
an idea.
The reason that the goddamn thing is so important, these people, most of the people that you were training or operating on, couldn't afford to come and get that treatment. So
that's right.
Did thumbs down. They were saying, tough luck for these chaps. They'll just have to continue on. You said it's going to cost money. It's technically complicated. And the reason that it's worth doing it is because they need it so badly.
Yeah. And also because it was a teaching machine.
I know. You could have had a teaching machine anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm talking about you didn't need to have this if you were just going to California.
No.
The whole point of it is you're going out to help people, just the reason you went to Newfoundland.
Yeah,
you wanted to learn. These were people who needed that first nurse who came, and you and your wife reorganizing things. That gave them a chance at something that was better. And the statistics at the end of the bloody book that I read 3 days ago and looked at it, and I said, holy mackerel, the number of people that you treated and trained is astounding. And these people would not have gotten that without this invention, period.
Well, Jack, you've been very kind to me, and I appreciate your insight, and it really sharpens my own realization of the fact that in each culture and in each endeavor, whether it's in architecture or medicine or whatever it is, there are comparable efforts that go on in which ambition develops and ambition can be fulfilled. It takes sometimes a lot of confidence and ego, as you pointed out. It should avoid arrogance, as I pointed out, and yet it provides a satisfaction of achieving. And I think maybe we ought to leave it at that the essence, I think, of the book I tried to write, with all of its joking around and anecdotal stuff, the essence really is to say, you know, you can build your life in this world. You can build it according to your own attributes and proclivities. But no matter what you're choosing to do, it's never going to be an easy course. And it's going to be one that's probably, the more original it is, the more offbeat it is, the more criticism you get. And so you have to be ready for that. And you're right. You pointed out earlier that I had my own share of failures. No question about that. So failure is a part of it. But in the end, Jack, I think you and I have both shared one thing in conclusion, and that is that we both had very happy, rewarding lives in different professions. And I want to see your book, and I want you to call and ask if I'll be involved in a blog with you someday. So I think
you may well be.
I hope so. Anyway, I want to thank you so much.
Here's the catch. People need doctors. They do not need architects.
I don't know. You have to have
architecture is a luxury,
yeah.
And it's one of the first things that people stop doing when the going gets tough. But,
well,
of course, people go to places to see things that are built. And as many people have said, architecture shapes the people who shape them. Those people who make architecture are making something that shape other people. And all of the great cities of the world, Oxford, where I went to school, once you go there, the world is different. And Paris, when you go there, the small New England village, the Iranian town out in the desert, you go there and you just wonder how superb it is. And they are all about life.
Yeah.
All about life. So in a curious way, what I do is close to what you do.
Yeah, you do wonderful things, and they're so appreciated. I have to tune us out, but I want to thank you so much, Jack, for your very helpful and distinctive comments that I knew would be the case. I knew that you would make wonderful observations of that value. You've done a lot to push forward this little memoir of mine called Second Sight.
Well, it's a really important book to read.
Yeah, well, that's so nice.
It's an News important
from
book
Dr.
to
Odyssey.
Read.
And let me just add, too, that this show is produced by Rare Bird Lit, and it's on Blog Talk Radio, and so that there are a lot of people behind the scenes who make this kind of thing possible for those of us who write books and try to have them brought to the attention of others. So I got to say, I'm not just grateful to you, but I'm so grateful to Tyson Cornell and Christina Galante and their corporate effort that has made this possible. So, Jack, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you soon.
David, thank you, my friend.
Deeply in your debt. Bye-bye.
All right.